Okay, good morning. I think we are going to start this morning session, and I have the great pleasure to introduce Sir John Pendry, who is going to give the first talk. So John Pendry is a condensed matter physicist. He began his career at the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, and since the 80s, he's been a professor at Imperial College in London. And in the 90s, he started to turn his attention to photonic materials. And so it's a shift from condensed matter physics to optics. And this is when he put forward this very interesting and fascinating property of materials or ensembles with negative refractive index, and this fascinating property of invisibility. So now I let the floor to him, and you are going to see more, or maybe see nothing, but about invisibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Are you going to fire up my talk?
This one, right?
Yeah. Okay, thank you, and thank you for that warm welcome, and thank you for showing up this morning. The first talk after the conference dinner is always a tough assignment. My group in London has been working on some new ideas in optics. They concern new materials that enable us to reproduce properties that have not been found in nature before, and they also include some new theoretical techniques which enables us to exploit those materials by giving very precise designs. And that's where invisibility came into the story, because we set ourselves the toughest test of what we could do with these materials, and we thought the toughest test might be to make something invisible. And eventually we were able to do that. So I want to begin with some background, and in optics the background goes back a very long way. It goes back much further than Snell even, but let's start with Snell, because Snell's law has been the design tool of choice for optics for very many years, and it is still used, of course, to design cameras and so on, but it has its limitations because it neglects the wave nature of light. It assumes that light is almost corpuscular in nature, with infinitely thin rays which refract at interfaces like this. Now, Snell's law enables you to design very perfect lenses, and Galileo was the first person to make a really, really good lens, which he used to observe the moons of Jupiter, of course. But even Galileo's lenses had a limitation to how finely they could focus. He didn't know about it at the time, but the wave nature of light limits how fine a focus you can achieve. You can't focus anything to much better than the wavelength of light. It's as if light is writing or drawing a picture with a pen that has a nib as wide as its wavelength. But if I have time, I'll show you that that is not an absolute limit to what you can do with light. We're doing much better these days. So if you want to be more precise about light, to control it on a scale of less than the wavelength, to control it perfectly, you have to look inside the wavelength. And when you do that, you see that light comprises two fields, the electric field and the magnetic field, and it's actually a dance. Light is a dance between the electric and magnetic fields, twirling from one to the other. The beat of the dance is the frequency, and the step of the dance is the wavelength. And one of the pillars on which that vision of light is built is Faraday's law of induction. Michael Faraday lived and worked in London. He worked at the Royal Institution. He came from a very humble background and had very little education, but he attended lectures at the Royal Institution and was eventually taken on as an assistant to Humphrey Davy, and really outshone Humphrey Davy with his own achievements eventually. But because he had very little mathematics, he always had a pictorial version of his science. And this is Faraday's way of thinking of a magnetic field. Before this time, when you talked about forces between objects, it was action at a distance. So Newton, for example, when he had his theory of gravitation, talked about the interaction of two objects between them was empty space. But Faraday had a different notion of force. If two magnets interact, he postulated that they did so via something which he called the magnetic field. And even if the second magnet was not present, and so there was no force being exerted, the field, the magnetic field of the first magnet was still there. Now, at that level, I suppose this is a philosophical point of whether there's action at a distance or whether there exists a field. But the proof of the field came relatively soon after this. Faraday could reveal his fields by scattering iron filings above a magnet on a piece of paper, and these are the field lines, the magnetic field lines. And Faraday's law says that if you change these field lines, if the field lines cut through a wire, then a voltage will be induced in that wire. And that's Faraday's law of induction, which says that a magnetic field can create an electric field. And this is the first step in the dance of light. The second step was taken by Maxwell. Now, Maxwell and Faraday were great friends, very, very different backgrounds. Faraday from a poor, humble home, not any mathematics. Maxwell was a Scottish laird from a rich background. He was a brilliant mathematician, perhaps the most brilliant applied mathematician of the 19th century, certainly in the United Kingdom. And he was a great friend of Faraday, and he reasoned that there should be some symmetry in these equations which govern electricity and magnetism. And he wrote Faraday's law like this. So B is a magnetic field, and if that changes, it produces an electric field. And Maxwell reasoned that if you have a changing electric field, then that will create a magnetic field. And I think it was Kelvin who suggested to Maxwell that he might look for a wave-like solution of those equations which he created. And Maxwell very soon found those solutions. My pointer's giving up here. Very soon found those solutions, and he showed that there was a wave-like solution with a certain velocity. And at that time, the velocity of light was already known, and he checked the velocity that he'd found, which is essentially the ratio of the electric to the magnetic units, and he found that they were the same. And that was a tremendous revelation, because it meant that this, first of all, it meant that we knew what light was, that it was really electric and magnetic fields working together. But secondly, perhaps even more important, another pointer, thank you very much, very helpful. Yes. Secondly, and perhaps even more important, this idea of field became more solid. So you can argue about whether forces between two magnets are due to action at a distance or whether they're due to a field. But if you shake the magnet or you shake an electric charge, what Maxwell had shown is you can actually shake off the fields. So if I shake an electric charge, for example, in an aerial in my mobile phone, the fields can take off and have a life of their own. And you're actually receiving these fields, which were conceived by Faraday, long ago. You're actually receiving those in your mobile phone signals. So Maxwell's equations are a complete description of light at the classical level. And to go beyond them, you have to look at very subtle quantum mechanical effects, which are actually difficult to detect. This man will enter into our story. He needs no introduction. And what he showed was that not only should you describe electric and magnetic fields, forces in terms of fields, but also Newton's picture of action at a distance needed changing, and that you should also describe the gravitational force in terms of a gravitational field. And he postulated that gravity acted by bending the space around massive objects. And the reason planets go in an orbit is they're actually traveling in a space which is bent. Now, if you write Maxwell's equations, including the formalism of bent space, which Einstein postulated, then you find that the effects of gravity appear as a refractive index in those equations. And so Einstein predicted that massive objects should act like lenses and should bend light. And it was the revelation that that was the case by Eddington in 1919, that starlight is bent by a massive object, that really propelled Einstein from being merely a very brilliant and famous scientist to being the icon of 20th century science. It created a huge furore because what it meant was that light, which was commonly perceived as a massless object, could be bent by the forces of gravity, and that the vacuum was not nothingness, emptiness, but actually was a material of some sort with properties which could be changed. And that was a huge revelation. So with that introduction, I come to this mathematical technique which we have developed. This is the old optics from Snell and Descartes, a ray approximation. It describes refraction at discrete interfaces. And also, in the old optics, we had a limited number of materials to play with, a very restricted range of optical properties. So in our new vision, we want to go beyond the ray approximation. We want to be able to look inside the wavelength and control light on a sub-wavelength scale. That means controlling the electric and magnetic fields so that we can do sub-wavelength optics. And we want to exploit the potential of these new materials, metamaterials, which I'll come to later in my talk. Excuse me. So this is the idea which really derives from Einstein's idea that space is a sort of plastic substance. So what we do is to imagine that we have a ray of light and that it's embedded in some flexible medium, which might be rubber, and that we can record its trajectory on a coordinate system, which I've labeled here as X and Y. And then if we want to distort the trajectory of that light, we pull the rubber sheet and distort it, and carrying the light with it, because the light is fixed to the sheet. And as we do this, we distort the coordinate system. Now, Maxwell's equations have a very curious property, and that is that if you write them in any coordinate system, they look the same. And all that changes is not the form of Maxwell's equations, but the values of the permittivity, the electrical permittivity, and the magnetic permeability that you substitute into them. And so that enables us to calculate the refractive index in this new set of coordinates. And if we introduce this new refractive index obtained from the coordinate transformation, then a material with this property will send light along this trajectory. And that's why it's called transformation optics, because from the transformation which pushes the light in the direction you want it to go, you can obtain a refractive index which will achieve that property. So, finally, invisibility. So we set ourselves this challenge of making something invisible using this new technology. So this is Peter Pan, or rather his statue, which sits in Kensington Gardens, just outside my college. And perhaps you remember that Peter Pan was a little boy who lost his shadow. And I use him as my mascot here, because you can quite easily see that black is not enough. So in conventional stealth in radar, if you arrange that an aeroplane doesn't reflect any radar waves, then that's usually good enough to make it invisible. But mainly, aeroplanes operate in a radar dark background, whereas in optics, we operate in a very bright background. Those of you who play squash, the game of squash, know that you play it with a black ball, but in a very brightly illuminated court. And so the ball is highly visible. Actually, it's not the ball that's visible, it's its shadow. So to make something truly invisible, it has not only not to reflect light, but it also has to have no shadow. And removing the shadow is a much more difficult task, but when you've done it, you have true invisibility. So, what we need to do is to take the rays of light, which, of course, if they were traveling through free space, would just go in a straight line, and then we define two volumes. The first volume, I take it to be a sphere here, it could have any shape you want, is a volume in which we're going to hide something. You shouldn't be able to see anything inside that volume. And the second volume is an annulus surrounding the sphere, but confined within another outer sphere. And in this volume, we're going to insert some material. And the function of that material is to guide the light away from the hidden object, so that it never reflects from it, and then return it to exactly the same trajectory it would have had had this whole thing not been in the way. Now, what I can do is to, so we got to make light flow in a continuous curve. And actually, excuse me, I've picked up a bug of some sort. There are examples in nature of light traveling in a smooth curve. For example, if we take a mirage, commonly thought to exist in the desert, that you probably all know how this works, but I'll remind you anyway. So the essential ingredient is that the sun heats the sand, which in turn creates a layer of hot air above the desert surface. And that creates a density gradient and also, of course, a gradient in the refractive index. So when the light comes from the sky, because the refractive index is changing, it does not travel in a straight line. And if the gradient is sufficiently great, the light can be reflected from the surface of the desert. And what you see is the sky reflected in the surface of the desert. And your mind says, What does that? Water. So this looks like an oasis, and the poor traveller is fooled. In Northern Europe, we're more common to see these road mirages, where on a hot summer's day, the tarmac, black tarmac, gets hot, and you see these shimmering wet roads in the distance. And when you get there, the road is perfectly dry, of course. So it is possible to bend light in a curved trajectory by grading the refractive index. To do this, we have to, ordinary glass doesn't have a gradient in the refractive index, so you have to have these new materials called metamaterials, whose properties we can tailor at will. So the next thing I need to do is to tell you what a metamaterial is. Metamaterial is very similar in some ways to an ordinary material. So in an ordinary material, it's the response of the atoms and molecules to the electric field of light that determines how refracting glass or water is. And the response, the electrical response of the glass, is determined by the average over many, many individual molecules of glass. And if you want to change the properties of glass, you change its chemical composition. You can add a bit of lead to make it more refracting. Metamaterials go one step further and say that, yes, these units have to be tiny, so you want many millions of them in one, or hundreds, certainly, in one cubic wavelength, but they don't have to be atoms and molecules. So the wavelength is about half a micron, and there are the billions of molecules in half a micron, and you could make the molecules bigger. In fact, you could make them big enough that you can manufacture them yourself, rather than rely on the chemists to make a molecule. And so a metamaterial is a material in which you have these super molecules whose structure determines the properties of the material. So it's function through structure rather than function through chemistry. And because the structure is almost infinitely variable, you can engineer a very wide range of properties, some of which have never been realized in nature. Here's the first example made at Marconi Company 10 or 15 years ago now by Mike Wilcher. And these are copper rings. Copper isn't magnetic, of course, but because it's formed into a ring, then this material actually has a magnetic response in the gigahertz region. So you get magnetism without magnets, and that's just one of the tricks you can make. This is another structure made earlier on at UCSD by David Smith, my longtime collaborator, and he's used this split ring structure and introduced some wires as well. And he's actually made a material in which turns out that if you make the electric and magnetic responses both negative, which this structure achieves, you can actually achieve negative refraction. And that it never occurs in nature. So people have been having fun making negative refraction. But the cloak doesn't involve negative refraction, but it does involve some esoteric properties. So here are the rings again, and they're formed into a circle. And this is an experiment not with light, but with microwaves, still an electromagnetic radiation. And the structure is graded from this shape on the outer ring to this shape in the inner ring to give you the refractive index profile that you need to bend radar waves around this hidden volume here in the middle. That's just a picture of the setup. It's a two-dimensional waveguide. The radar waves travel between two sheets of aluminium. This is absorbing material. Here's the cloak. There's a hidden region, and the radar waves come in. And I'm going to show you a map of the fields in this region around here. So this is what a perfect cloak would do. It guides the rays around the hidden object. These are the wave fronts, and you see that they too are guided around, of course. Now, it turns out that even with metamaterials, at that time, it wasn't possible to realize the exact properties, and in any case we wanted to do the experiment quickly because we knew there was competition coming. And this is what the theory predicts if you built the experiment as best you could. So, you know, it's doing the job of bending these rays around. They're a little bit wriggly. So what you'd see here would not be something which is completely invisible. You'd see a gray patch in the sky. Okay? Of course, some of the light goes where it shouldn't do. So a copper cylinder in here, and of course that scatters the light like mad. But if you put the cloak around, you can see it's making quite a good approximation in the experiment to the exact properties. And so that released a firestorm of press interest. On the day the paper was published, I was in the radio van at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't stop talking to journalists till 10 o'clock at night. I think the high point was when we got our picture of our cloak into the New York Times and front page of the Science Times. So that was fun. But people said, well, hey, you know, this is not Harry Potter stuff. It's, first of all, it's radar waves, and what we want is a cloak for light. And also we want a big cloak. So the next step was to go on and in order to make a cloak for visible light, you do need to simplify the design somewhat. And this is a design which we called hiding under the carpet, because it assumes that you have a mirror here, a reflecting plane, okay? And then what you want to do is to create a tunnel here in which you're going to hide something. And then you need to introduce a refractive index such that when light is incident on this tunnel, it refracts just as though that tunnel were flat. So what you have to do is start off with coordinate system in which everything is square and then compress the coordinate system, and that will tell you the refractive index change that makes this tunnel seem as though it's not there, as though it's invisible. And if you do that, so here is the tunnel, and of course it's got two facets to it. So if light is incident on a tunnel, you actually see not one reflected ray as you would from a flat mirror, you see two, one from each facet. And so if I shone my laser beam over this uncloaked object, it would go flash, flash as you shone the beam over the tunnel. But if you put the cloak in place, then you should see a single beam. And that experiment was done in Berkeley by Chang Sang's group. Why do I acknowledge them? I should acknowledge them. And so here's the cloaked area. This is all very tiny. This is like a few microns across. And this is the simplest possible metamaterial. The gradient in the refractive index is achieved simply by making the silicon less dense by drilling holes in it. And here's a picture of the cloak with an electron microscope. Here's the cloaking region. This is the cloaked bump. And here are the data. So this is what a flat surface does. It produces theory and experiment, I think. It produces a single reflective beam. If you have a bump there, it produces several beams from the facets of the bump. But if you put the cloak in place, then you're back to a single beam again. So you really have hidden that thing and made the whole thing look like a flat mirror. Well, some people are never satisfied. And so people said, well, you know, this is only a few microns across. So is that really interesting? And then, two groups, Zhuang Sang's team at Birmingham and a Singapore team, both had the same idea. And they realized that there's a natural material called calcite, which if you create a triangular region like that and you put some calcite prisms on the top, then calcite has exactly the right properties that this would hide this region here. And the dimensions now are centimeters, rather than microns. So here's the theory. What we want is a cloak to do this, if the cloak wasn't there, you'd see these multiple beams again. So the way the Birmingham team illustrated that was to take an image of the alphabet. So if you have no cloak in place, then the two facets of the hidden region mix the alphabet up, C, D, R, S, T, U. Okay, and here's the division between the two prisms. The two sides of the inclusion. But if you put the calcite prisms in case, H, I, J, K, L, the alphabet comes right. By the way, this is done in white light, so this is a broadband cloak. It works for many frequencies in the visible. Okay, so that is a cloaking story. But as I said at the beginning, the cloaking was only brought into play because we wanted a really, really difficult challenge for our technology. But the point is not so much that we can cloak something well or badly. The point is that this technology exists. It can do cloaking, but it can do many, many other things as well. So just to remind you, if we can find the right materials, and metamaterials can often help us, then we can send light in any direction we want. And something we can actually do is to create a material with a negative refractive index, which was first postulated by Vassalargo. And that has some very interesting properties. So what is a negative refractive index? Well, here's Snell's law, which defines the refractive index in terms of the ratio of the sines of these angles. And if one of these angles goes this way instead of that way, then this is classed as a negative angle. And materials which have this chevron sort of refraction have a negative refractive index. Now, it turns out that if you go back to Einstein, Einstein described the properties of space in terms of something he called a metric. And the metric defines how much a gravitational object squashes or stretches a piece of space. And if you go into Maxwell's equations and ask where the metric appears, it sits in exactly the same place as the refractive index does. And that's why a massive object behaves like a big lens. But we're going to grab hold of that idea and say, the refractive index, now represents a notional squashing of space. Excuse me, I'm going to do some origami. So one thing I can do is to take some flat space and then I can squash this central region. And of course, as I squash it, the effective refractive index becomes greater and greater. Of course, the light has to traverse that region with the same phase that it would have traversed the longer region. And as I get to the point where I've squashed this to nothing, the refractive index is infinite. Now, if you're a mathematician, infinities don't trouble you, and you can go right through them. And now, I've made a piece of space which is negative. But I think you can see from the topology of this sheet that making something negative has some interesting properties, because under these conditions, space is triple valued. And that has some interesting consequences, which I'll show you. So one of the things which Vassalargo pointed out was that if you have a negative refractive index making this chevron type of refraction, the light is bent back towards the axis and comes to a natural focus. In fact, it produces two foci, one inside and one outside the material. Now, the interpretation of that according to Einstein is that as far as the light is concerned, the refractive index looks like the metric of space. It doesn't to you and me, of course, but to the light, it behaves as though this is a piece of negative space. So we could redraw this diagram here, in which the light goes, we see the light going through a piece of negative refractive index material, and what the light thinks it's doing is it hits this material and think, uh-oh, we have some negative space here, so I have to go backwards, and then positive space, and it goes forward again. And so if you have a focus here, that focus is encountered three times, once, twice, thrice. And in the context of Maxwell's equations, this picture of negative space is exact. And so these foci have a unique property. And that is that if you have an image with sub-wavelength details here, those sub-wavelength details will be reproduced here and reproduced here as well. And so Bessel-Argo's lens, as I pointed out in 2000, actually is a perfect lens if you make it perfectly. And the only thing stopping it from being perfect will be how well you can make it. And if you can make it perfectly, then you get perfect images with resolution beyond the limits of the wavelength. So, well, that lens has been built and demonstrated to have sub-wavelength resolution. But you can also do something else. You can say, well, this may be perfect, but it's not very interesting because usually I want a lens to make something bigger or smaller. Well, no problem. As we know, space is really a rubber sheet. We can stretch the object to be as big as we want, and we can crush, the image to be as big as we want, and the object to be as small as we want. And this thing, so I'm going to bend this round to make a cylinder or a spherical annulus out of it, your choice. And we can actually make a spherical object like this. And then in this particular lens with these parameters here, this negatively refracting lens would magnify the contents of this green sphere so that they appeared to be bigger than either the original sphere or the lens itself. That's a very curious situation, which I'll leave you to puzzle around. Here's some ray tracing. You may ask why these rays, which don't hit the lens, nevertheless come into the lens. And the proof of that is here, which is a solution of Maxwell's equations. And you see that all the waves which hit this big red circle are squashed into this little green one here. And finally, what sort of fun can we have with that? Well, there are many instruments in optics which only work if they're very big. And the simplest of these is the shadow. So if I take something which is a centimeter across and black, and I have a point source of light, it will produce a very sharp shadow. But if I have a really small piece of object, even though it's black, it will not create a shadow if its size is less than the wavelength. And the reason is that light is a wave, and waves can diffract around small objects, and the shadow is filled in and never really created. However, this lens provides a solution to this problem, because if we want to create a shadow with a really small object, we place the black object inside here, and then the lens will make the black object much bigger than even the lens itself, and so we should see a very big black object, and that will cast a sharp shadow. And my student Wei Xiong Wei has done some simulations of that. Ignore this, I don't have time to talk about it. So here we have a black object surrounded by this magnifying lens, which makes the black object seem as big as this. And here is a wave incident from the left, and you can see the wavelength from the distance between the crests here, and you can see this object, which alone would not create a shadow, now creates a shadow much bigger than any of the physical objects creating it. And so with that, I hope I've shown you that We have some technology which can do some very interesting things, some of them funny, some of them remarkable, some of them almost unbelievable. The discussions, let's say, that we've had over some of the devices we've designed have been rather intense. But we're certainly having a great time exploiting these new technologies of transformation optics and metamaterials, not least in making cloaks. So thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot for this fascinating talk. Are there any questions, comments?
Thank you. It was very. Can you hear?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. It was very interesting. But I'm curious whether you can increase the lens's numerical aperture to increase the resolution without severe distortions.
Yes. The question concerned the numerical aperture of a lens. The aperture of a lens is relevant to resolution down to the limit of the wavelength. And of course, you need to achieve in conventional optics to achieve infinite best resolution, you need an infinite aperture lens. But when you're collecting sub-wavelength radiation, because the wavelength is very short, the transverse wavelength is very short, the aperture becomes a less relevant factor. And you can, in fact, achieve very high sub-wavelength resolution with apertures which are quite small. The criteria become very complex for the resolution with a sub-wavelength lens. It's not a simple matter of numerical aperture.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this talk. Would you be able to comment on the relationship between this technique for going beneath the wavelength of light with resolution and the nonlinear optics saturation effects, which has already played a significant role in biotech areas? And
yes.
Do you think that this will also play a role in the microscopic application areas?
Yes, the question relates to a very fascinating technique in which you can get sub-wavelength resolution by essentially bleaching out the response of dyes using intense lasers. That does achieve a very good sub-wavelength resolution, but of course there are some as with any technology, there are some limitations. One is that you do need a high power laser, and second, that you do need present in your sample fluorophores of exactly the right nature that can be bleached in this way. So the perfect lens is at an earlier stage of its development. That the challenges there are to make it perfectly, because there has been a suggestion that you can make it out of silver metal. And the problem with engineering metals is making the surfaces perfectly flat. For a mirror in a telescope, you need surfaces which are flat to better than the wavelength. But if you're going to see things which are smaller than the wavelength, then you have to be much better than that. And in fact, the requirement is that silver be flat to a tenth of a nanometer. That is a huge challenge. That's almost atomically flat, excuse me. And people are getting there, but the technology is a very difficult one.
Behind you.
Can you comment on what the implications of your work are for computing?
For what? Security?
The implications of your work for computing, ICT.
For computers. Well, yes, the one of the reasons that we're interested in subwavelength optics is that light, which is the preferred means of communication, all the telephone conversations, internet traffic, goes across the Atlantic by optical fiber. The contrast between that and the components of a computer, which operate with electrons for the greater part. The scale of an optical fiber is tens of microns. The scale of the chip in your computer is tens of nanometers. And although we talk about optics, optoelectronics is a conversation between a mouse and an elephant. And in order to make that conversation flow freely and to integrate optics more, much more into the internal workings of the computer, we have to be able to control light on a sub-wavelength scale, because otherwise it's just this elephant in the room. We've got to look at the small components of light. There's one here.
Mayor, two small questions. The first question is, to what extent this concept which derives from electromagnetic waves could be translated to longitudinal waves like sounds or, let's say, on the water? And a second question is related to the previous one. Well, am I right to say that if we have a source of light which is surrounded by this negative material, so simply nothing comes out, so it can be like a reverse problem to the cloaking?
Yes. Okay, the first question relates to whether you can cloak objects to other waves, and the answer is yes. There's been quite a lot of work on acoustic cloaking, and people have designed cloaks which can be hide volume from sound. There's also been a suggestion that one could control ocean waves in this way and hide some vulnerable object from an ocean wave. I doubt you could build a cloak big enough to hide it from a tsunami, because the tsunami has a wavelength of, I think, about a kilometer in the open ocean. But certainly there are possibilities for protecting beaches and so on from the ordinary sort of 5-meter waves which you see in the Atlantic. The second question concerned, remind me what your second question was. That was,
well, the question is just to reverse the cloaking problem, which means, yes, you put a source within the cloak, and then does it mean that no signal comes out of it?
Yes, that's exactly right. You've actually created two spaces which are completely disconnected from one another optically. I mean, that's not a remarkable thing. You can just take Beko foil, aluminium foil, and wrap it round yourself, and light wouldn't get out. There's always some absorbing material inside, and the light, just as it is in this room, will bounce around quite a bit and eventually will be absorbed. So no great paradox there.
Okay, I think we have to stop here in spite of maybe other questions that could be asked, because we would be too late with the program. Let's thank Sir John Pedry again.